Across Divides is a podcast that discusses challenges faced by communities around the island of Ireland. In this season, we're taking a deep dive into Carlingford Lough and the Shifting Tides Project, connecting coastal communities between the shores of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. We speak with scientists, artists, and communities about the different ways they understand the sea, exploring creative approaches to protect it. Learn more at theshiftingtides.org. The undersea world is largely out of sight, inaccessible. This means it can sometimes be perceived as an empty space or a blank canvas to be filled by the wonders of human imagination and weird stories. Scientific research has given us plenty of answers when it comes to understanding marine environments. We are now more aware of complex ensembles of marine life and ways that we impact them. But what we discover can sometimes be so bizarre that a little creative interpretation might be needed. In this episode of Across Divides, we will be taking a deep dive into Carlingford Lough, meeting with some of the people who venture beneath its waters and hearing about the strange things they have seen there. Muireann and Eloisa are two young people from the shores of Carlingford Lough. They both have a love for the water, and this is something they want to share with others. I spoke with them about some of the issues they're concerned about and both the scientific and the creative approaches they are taking to address them.
So I'm Muireann. I am an art student in Our Ladies. I study in geography and environmental technology alongside art. My art is mostly based on the environment. This year, I'm looking at the reality of climate change. And in previous years, I've looked at the relationships between us and the sea through ceramics. This year, I'm looking at it through fashion design. My interest in the sea comes from living right beside the sea. I look out the window and I can see the sea from here. I'm a sailing instructor in Killowen Yacht Club. I'm on the water most of the day and most of the summer, and I try to get out as much as I can during the winter.
While Muireann spends a lot of time on the water, Eloisa is a scuba diver.
I started diving last June. I was introduced by my dad. He said, "You got to try this." I went, "Well, it's not my thing," but I did a try dive, and after that, fell in love with it. As soon as I did that, I realized, nope, let's get these courses through. I need to get all of these done. I then wanted to teach, so I thought, what better than to do a simple course? So I now teach snorkeling. So for like little kids, so they can see the water, even if they're not old enough to go underneath. And it's great because whenever you're above the water, you think, oh, there's some fish. But whenever you get to go down underneath, you're shocked at how much else there is underneath you. The best experience I've had is at night, whenever you do a night dive and all you have is a torch and that's the only visibility you have. You get to see little bits of like fish come up to you, like really close. You're like, oh, like you can't see anything else around you. It's very magical.
Muireann, your ceramics are otherworldly. They're the sort of thing I imagine Eloisa might encounter on a night dive. Considering that you spend most of your time above the water, what is it that inspired you to create these animals that appear as though they've come from the deepest parts of the sea? Creatures you've never set eyes on that might not even exist.
It's mostly looking at the barnacles and the shells that were coming up onto the shore that obviously had a purpose further down in the sea. So I can see them on rocks, on the side of walls, on the bottom of boats. And I can see that they really have life above the water. And I was looking at more and more things that I could see below the water, obviously, but that were coming up towards the surface for me to see, because I can't see it when it's down there. And there were different inspirations from seaweed that was coming up on the beach, jellyfish that were coming up on the beach, and the things that I knew were down there, but I couldn't see. A lot of the colors, I've guessed, a lot of different shapes and forms. I've had to go off what I've seen and whatever I created. I don't know if it's the truth of what's going on down there, but it was my kind of venture into what I could see. And I know I've seen things dead and come up on the beach, like oysters and different things like that. But I wanted to add life back into them. So bring their colors out and bring out the life that is below the sea that I was seeing above the sea.
Eloisa, how would you say your experience of the sea compares or differs with Muireann's?
I'm just amazed that Muireann's able to just visualize, see the water and not be able to go underneath and have all these creations, because I know me, I have imagination, but yours must be wild if you're able to just construct these things from seeing bits of debris on the beach and using your imagination. It is brilliant. And I do envy that you have that imagination.
I I don't know how I created all the stuff I did. It was a few months when I just sat, and it was a wee niche interest of mine, and it was just something I wanted to create more and more shapes and more figures and textures of what I thought was going on down there. And some of my stuff is totally made up. Like, I know that these things aren't happening under there, but it was so much freedom I had and so much creativity that I could see. But I would love to be able to see it from your perspective, where you actually know what's going on down there and you can actually see what's happening, which I think would be so interesting to see, even at any point in my life, where I could go, oh, I got that maybe, right? I kind of have that sitting there. It's something like what I did. Or I could just be like, I was so far off. And it shows how little I know, because I don't have that access to what's going on under there. But it's so amazing that you do.
It's sometimes difficult to know what's really going on underwater, and it can take some creative interpretation. And there's something nice about that, because we don't always need to know exactly what's happening. But there are certain situations, especially when we think of the issues affecting our oceans amidst these multiple planetary crises. Eloisa, you're interested in learning about the sea from a scientific perspective. In fact, you're looking at studying marine biology at university.
Whenever I do scuba diving, it's nice to say, oh, I recognize that coral, or I know that, but it'd be great to have like the knowledge of going, I know how that's made, I know where that came from, I know that species, and how do I protect that, and knowing everything I need to, I don't like feeling like I don't know something when I should, when I'm interested in it. And I thought, oh, scuba diving, yeah, but let's do marine biology. So if I study that, I get to do something I'm interested in, and I get to learn more things about something that can help me understand the ocean more, instead of just going, that's coral, that's seaweed, I know what this is, and you know how to protect it, or you can realize if something's in danger. So I want to be able to teach and study that.
There is a lot of inspiration for you both from the sea, whether that be the pursuit of knowledge or creative expression. You both pay a great deal of attention to the water. I wonder if there are issues that have raised your concern in Carlingford Lough.
See, whenever I'm on the water, a lot of the time I'm seeing animals pop their head above the water. So I've seen dolphins while I'm out. I've seen seals. I see a lot of guillemots about, and jellyfish. The thing that sometimes concerns me is they're changing patterns of where they are and how early they're coming and how early they're leaving and the volumes of them. I know for jellyfish, they prefer the warmer temperatures of the sea. The more that there are, the more worried I've become with the different climates and things like that. All of this pollution and all this damage we cause by doing the things we sometimes love and want to do is going to stop our ability to do them in the future, which is probably the most concerning thing to me, the pollution and the change of the weather and how cold this summer was, and how much rain there was, the different weather patterns that are affecting my sailing and things like that, that weren't always happening whenever I was younger and have changed a lot, even just in my life. I'm looking to explore climate change through art and how, not art versus science, but in a way of how visual representation of climate change might have a more emotional impact on someone who's viewing it and might inspire more of passion or inspiration to act against it. Facts and figures are amazing, and they will aid my work a lot and help me be able to represent what I want to say very easily. But is there an easier way to translate this information into a way that the general public will be able to have a more emotional connection with?
Eloisa dives with Oceanauts in Ross Trevor, and in just a moment, we'll be hearing from Dane, who runs the dive center there. In partnership with Dundalk Sub Aqua Club and Shifting Tides, the Oceanauts team recently conducted a cleanup of underwater rubbish from Greencastle Beach. This is a dive site that you're very familiar with, Eloisa. How did your experience of the cleanup change your perspective on the place?
Well, before the beach cleanup, I didn't really notice the rubbish as much. You'd go past one wee thing, but whenever we specifically focused on looking for the rubbish underneath the water, it was terrifying how much we saw. And we came back with bags and bags of rubbish, and it really hit home. We're like, this needs sorted out, because we've got piles here and there's still more. I mean, we felt like we needed to go back in hundreds of times, because we thought, no, we need to get all this out. We physically couldn't, but it really was upsetting seeing all that rubbish there.
Both Eloisa and Murin have spoken about how being part of a community with an interest in the sea is something they have been supported by and which they want to give back to in some way. Building a community of people who care for the ocean was at the forefront of Dane McParland's mind when he set up Oceanauts Scuba Diving Centre. Originally from Ross Trevor, the diving instructor spent a number of years working as a scientific diver in the United Arab Emirates before returning home in 2022. His time away gave him a new perspective on the waters of Carlingford Lough.
I really notice here, like in Carlingford Lough, that there is a big seasonal change. So in the summertime, there's more happening and, you know, there's more vegetation, there's more life underwater in that sort of intertidal, subtidal area. And then in the wintertime, it does seem like it quietens down, like it gets everything. And it's the same on the surface as it is underwater to a certain aspect. You know, things start to quiet down. Obviously, the leaves fall off the trees and everything in autumn here. And, you know, we have animals that go into hibernation. And then below the surface, there's a certain mirrored effect to that where it does seem like it starts to quieten down as it comes into the winter. Now, I say it quiets down as in that you don't get as much life, but in fact, obviously things become a bit rougher in the wintertime. You know, we start to get storms and things like that. So that actually affects who's around the kind of, in terms of the animals that are around that kind of subtidal, intertidal area. And then with the lack of sunlight, as we start to explore a wee bit deeper in the wintertime, it's darker. The sunlight doesn't penetrate as far. So if you're lucky and you get a really nice clear day in the wintertime and you get right sort of midday, you might still have a bit of sunlight down there. But yeah, if it's any kind of overcast in the wintertime, it's dark. So that sunlight doesn't get as far. And then obviously that affects how things photosynthesize. And there was a really nice thing for me coming back and seeing that and seeing seasonality, you know, underwater. It's quite cool. Like I really enjoy it and I enjoy seeing how it shifts over the course of the year.
The seasonality of the undersea is not just a matter of light, but also sound. And there is a lot that can be learned with a fine-tuned ear.
In the wintertime, if you do get a calm kind of day, there is less kind of noise underwater. Whereas in the summertime, it can actually be quite loud, especially with whenever we get lots and lots of the crabs, the crustaceans out and about. They're moving around a lot and even just nibbling on stuff and moving stones around, things like that. And you can hear it, like you notice it underwater. You can hear all the little clicks and clacks. And it's something that researchers have actually looked into in recent years of like the sounds of a healthy underwater ecosystem, in particular coral reefs. And how does that sound? And a healthy coral reef is a loud place. There's a lot of sound going on. And the same could be said for our kind of rocky reefs. Whenever they're healthy and there's a lot happening, they're quite a loud place. There's a lot happening. There's a lot of animals, especially with the amount of crabs that we get at Greencastle. They're really moving around a lot and constantly picking at stuff and moving things around. So yeah, you do hear quite a lot of that, like little, you know, clicks and clacks, I would describe them as.
If you want to hear more about underwater soundscapes, look out for the Across Divides episode with composer Karen Power, who has been listening carefully to the creatures of Carlingford Lough. Dane says the strong tides in the Lough mean the waters exchange and mix with the Irish Sea, and this makes it a rich and varied environment. He's keen to make use of his skills in scientific research to better understand what's going on underwater.
If you have a better understanding of an ecosystem and of an environment, and if you're more invested in it that way, where you're literally part of the study of it and you're learning more about it, inevitably you tend to care more. And it's that kind of caring and generating a community of people who are interested in it. And then that for me is the really, really important thing. You know, we have such a like vibrant, amazing ecosystem around, like not just where we are in the east coast of Ireland, but the whole of Ireland. We're an island on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean. We're surrounded by water, surrounded by amazing biodiversity. And I feel like there isn't as much of an understanding of what really is just beyond that water's edge as what really we should have. I almost had a bit of a shock myself where I went, wow, I didn't realize that we had so many seals living in the mouth of the lock. I didn't realize it was such a big colony of them sitting there. You know, I didn't realize that we could get so many different species of sharks. I didn't realize that we had things like basking sharks actually made their way the whole way around sometimes. And that we had like the likes of bottlenose dolphins at the mouth of the lock. It was something that I even had a realization that my understanding wasn't as good as I thought maybe it was. And, you know, the more you get out there, the more you see, the more you want to learn. And it's just kind of like, it's this sort of feedback loop.
Dane sees incredible marine life on a daily basis, but he's also come face to face with the effects of human activity on the sea. And one of the main issues that he encounters in Carlingford Lough is rubbish. He arranged the underwater cleanup at Greencastle Beach, and his reflections on the effort are similar to those of Eloisa.
By and large, a huge amount of what we were finding was debris from aquaculture, right? So we were finding these rubber straps with hooks on them that are used by some of the shellfish farms, the aquaculture in the loch. Yeah, we did find the odd normal rubbish, whatever you want to call it, everyday kind of stuff, crisp packets and bottles and things like that. But that was actually the minority. Then on top of that, you know, we had some strange things, you know, the old tire and things like that. And every now and again, you'd go on a dive and you'd see these sort of things. And I realized that it was a problem, but I think that cleanup really made me realize how bad the problem is. There's other pressures that are there in the loch. Fishing, commercial fishing will always be a pressure, but particularly in an environment where it's quite closed off, you've only got one entrance, one exit, you know, it's a very, very tidal area. And for there to be commercial mussel trawling happening like right down at Warren Point, and I mean at the water's edge basically, to me seems, you know, where you have somewhere like Stranford Loch that is an MPA, it's a marine protected area, there's no commercial fishing happening in there. And I feel personally like Carniford Loch should have that same sort of protection in place. You know, you have such a closed off place, it's right in the middle of now UNESCO Geopark, right from Stranford the whole way down to Gullion, and yet there's no real protections in place for it. There's cases around the rest of Ireland where, you know, you've seen these protections go in, and success stories as well where, you know, these protections have gone in and then now you look at the biodiversity that's there and, you know, the recovery that they've seen in certain species. So these things work, like MPAs do work if they're set up correctly, and enforcement is obviously a big part of it. Whenever it comes to like mussel trawling, who's it benefiting? Does it benefit the people around the loch? Not really. In fact, if anything else, it's damaging their ecosystem for financial gain that really isn't going back into our community.
While his work gives him startling insights on the issues facing Carlingford Loch, Dane is still positive that sharing the undersea world with as many people as possible is the best way to get us excited about marine life and encourage its protection.
Hopefully then sort of next generation get interested in the sea and the ocean and, you know, what there is around our shores, because it is really cool and I love it. And I just want to tell people about it.
It is often said that humankind knows more about the surface of the moon than we do about the bottom of the sea. And marine science is uncovering new findings all the time. More marine species have been discovered in the past decade than ever before. In the summer of 2024, Shifting Tides partnered with Sea Search to deliver training for divers to conduct citizen science in Carlingford Loch. Sea Search is a project for divers and snorkelers to gather scientific data on marine environments. Claire Casey is the Northern Ireland coordinator, and she explains how diving can provide a unique perspective for science.
Well, I suppose whenever you consider a lot of citizen science, marine recording tends to take place in the intertidal. The intertidal is a particularly stressful zone for many organisms to live in. You're generally seeing or observing those species during a time when they're under sort of an even greater amount of stress, usually with the tide being out, desiccation stress and changes in salinity and temperature. So a lot of the time we're only really observing them in sort of a state of torpor, a state of like stasis, where it's just not that interesting to observe them. If you're walking along a rocky shore and you see limpets and barnacles, they won't be doing very much because obviously they need to try and survive until the tide comes back in again. Whenever you start to move into snorkeling and especially diving, where you're moving into the subtidal, you have organisms and communities that aren't facing that constant stress of tides moving in and out. You're probably exposed to a much more mobile, dynamic community. You'll probably see more clearly the relationships between organisms within that community, how they're interacting with each other, how they're feeding, for example. So even organisms that are ordinarily sessile and don't move around much and maybe aren't that interesting during an intertidal survey, you'll start to see them come to life once the tide is back in again and you're observing them with water over the top.
When Sea Search volunteers go out on a dive, they record observations about the environment they're diving in. Whether it's a rocky reef, a seagrass meadow, kelp forest, marl bed, or whether it's just sand. They also note the creatures they spot over the course of a dive, the fishes, crabs, anemones. The data is sent to the Sea Search team, who then verify and collate results that can be useful to scientific research.
Observing trends is probably one of the big things that our volunteers would observe. So, for example, the northerly movement of southern species, or what we would refer to as climate change indicator species, such as the snake lox, anemone shrimp. It originally had a much more southerly distribution, but we're starting to see its distribution moves slowly northwards up through the UK. The other thing that would probably be important is the monitoring of the likes of the movements of invasive species and priority species as well. So species that maybe have been subject to significant sort of fishing pressure in the past, or, you know, habitat destruction where their numbers have declined significantly. And we want to sort of keep tabs on where these species are occurring and ensure that the proper protections are in place to ensure that they're safeguarded, or the populations are safeguarded for the future.
Not only does citizen science feed into research that could benefit undersea environments, Claire thinks it enriches the experience of the divers themselves.
I think for a lot of people, maybe when they start diving, the drive can be to go as deep as possible, see as much as possible. But when it comes to marine recording, you then become so hyper aware of just how species rich much of these communities are, and how much you're actually seeing in front of you in the space of moving maybe a couple of meters. It definitely brings a new level of understanding and appreciation to your diving.
So, what sorts of things have sea search divers discovered in Carlingford Loch so far? And what does this say about the environmental dynamics and ecological communities that exist there? It's early days, but Claire and the divers have gathered a few observations so far.
Carlingford, from what we can see so far, I mean, we have a fairly significant aquaculture sort of taking place in Carlingford Loch, which probably tells us a lot about the kind of communities that it can support. Example, when we were out on our dive, our shore dive at Greencastle, you would have noticed there was an absolute plethora of anemones. What it would suggest is that you have sort of fairly strong currents in Carlingford that are bringing in fresh nutrients, fresh particles and bits of detritus, because all of these, the bivalves that you're getting, specific oysters that are being grown in the farms and the anemones themselves, they're all sort of filter passive feeders. They're all sort of removing material from the water. So it's really important that there's strong currents and enough sort of through flow there to constantly be bringing in that fresh source of nutrients.
All of the guests in this episode have a unique insight on the undersea world. They are awestruck by what they find underwater, and they want to share their discoveries with their communities, whether that be through art, science, or giving people the opportunity to see it for themselves. Phil Scott is a member of Dundalk Search and Rescue Sub-Aqua Club, who regularly scuba dive in Carlingford Loch. He is an avid underwater photographer, a passion that allows him to show others what he himself has the rare possibility to catch a glimpse of. Some of Phil's photographs were displayed as part of the Shifting Tides exhibition in Warren Point Town Hall, and visitors couldn't believe that the vibrant creatures were found beneath the waters of Carlingford Loch. There were nudibranchs, brightly coloured sea slugs with their lungs on the outside, scorpion crabs that cut fragments of sponge and attach them to decorate their shells, and pipefish that belong to the same family as seahorses.
Carlingford Loch is an amazingly rich, diverse ecosystem, I think. You know, I dive all around Ireland, but I find Carlingford Loch, and I don't know whether it's because of the flow of water in and out, you know, it's got very tidal, and you have a couple of fairly significant reefs in the loch, and the density of life and the variety of life is just crazy. You know, there's so much to see. I love feather stars, and I love nudibranchs, so I like the kind of macro life, just, and then the sponges as well. We have some amazing sponges, and just really nice. If you get good visibility, you get nice, there's lovely topography down there as well, so you can get good scenic shots as well as the more macro shots. But like, even on a day when the visibility is bad, if you put a macro lens on, you can get something out of the dive, because you just stay very close to the reef. You know, you might not be able to see too far either side of you, but it actually doesn't matter.
We've already seen how easily marine environments can slip out of sight. When a proposal was made to dump waste material from dredging in Warren Point Harbour, Phil and his fellow club members leveraged their unique position as scuba divers to raise a movement against ecological destruction.
Warren Point Port Harbour Authority, they basically dredge, they have to dredge the port regularly, and they were basically taking the dredge right out to sea, way past the outside of the lock. And obviously for cost reasons, they were looking to change their dredging kind of policy so they could dump in Carlingford Lock. And we looked at all the plans, and the dump sites were literally right in the lock next to the lighthouse, basically on top of all the reefs that we would dive all the time. So we kind of got very worked up about this, let's just say, and started putting together a whole kind of our story, really. And a few of us in the club worked on it. So put the whole story together about how we feel it would affect the marine life. And so we worked on the diversity of marine life and the density of marine life that was in the lock that you know, nobody was probably aware of. And then what we did is we compiled a load of images. They had a town hall meeting up in Warren Point. A few of us attended that meeting, and we took one of the club members, Francis, made a huge booklet of all the pictures that we had. And we attended that town hall. And I think a few members even attended a board meeting in Warren Point Harbour Authority. We got Friends of the Irish Environment involved as well. So they were very vocal for us as well in relation to the whole trying to prevent this happening. And they pulled it. And it was funny when we went up to the town hall, the CEO was there, and it was hard not to be a bit worked up, you know, because you knew these people were not really paying any attention. And we actually went up with the board and sat it in front of her and said, have a look at this. And we showed, and she couldn't believe what there was. Whether our actions were part of it, we'll never know. But within probably a month or two, the whole thing went away.
It's hard to deny life when you see it in full color. And Phil thinks the photographs had a huge impact.
They would have had to have done all these scientific studies, you know, which are all kind of data and statistics and all of that. And they have to do that as part of getting the thing across the line. That's fine, but it's not visual.
If you've been listening to our other episodes, then you might recognize some parallels with Colm Sand's story of the invisible tree in Kilbroney Forest. This was another case where community members took collective action to protect their local environment with a dash of creativity. The natural world is full of wonderful complexity that can be understood in a multitude of ways, each of which contribute to a wild and vivid narrative. There is still much to be learned about the sea, and probably far more than we will ever know. If you would like to learn more about the waters around our island, take a look at the description attached to this podcast or explore the resources on the Shifting Tides website. The intro and outro music for this podcast are from the Mind Orchestra and the Library of Congress Archive. The mysterious transitions are drawn from Karen Power's composition, Hidden Life of Carlingford Lough. You can hear the full piece in the Soundwaves episode in this series, along with conversations on citizen science, rewilding our seas, stories of smuggling and seaweed foraging. Throughout the series, we also gain insights on creative approaches to community-led marine conservation and hold challenging conversations about balancing coastal livelihoods with protecting our seas. To get involved with Shifting Tides and access a wealth of online resources, visit theshiftingtides.org. Shifting Tides is a recipient of the Creative Climate Action Fund, an initiative from the Creative Ireland Programme. It is funded by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media in collaboration with the Department of the Taoiseach. The fund supports creative, cultural and artistic projects that build awareness around climate change and empower citizens to make meaningful behavioural transformations. Shifting Tides is a project under the umbrella of the WEEL and NICFA's iCommunity programme, supported by the DFA, the Shared Island Civic Society Fund. iCommunity seeks to support the community and voluntary sector on the island of Ireland, working together on common issues such as community-led climate action. You can find out more at iCommunityHub.org. Thank you for listening.